Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Kelsey Giuliana is only 19 years old, but she's suing the state of Oregon, claiming it's not doing nearly enough to stop climate change and prevent the effects it will have on her generation and those to come.
If the state does not act now, we are facing irreversible, catastrophic crises.
Welcome to ClimateCast, everybody. I'm Paul Huttner. Young people in Oregon and other states are now suing in court to get answers on climate change. It's just one case in a coming wave of climate lawsuits. Today on ClimateCast, how much is climate change costing you and me? And who's legally liable for climate change damages? Let's ask the lawyers. Jay Austin is a senior attorney with the Environmental Law Institute and editor-in-chief of Environmental Law Reporter. Good morning, Jay.
Morning, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Professor Mehmet Konar-Steinberg is a chair in energy and environmental law at Mitchell Hamlin School in St. Paul. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Paul.
And Joseph Robertson is back with us. He's the global strategy director for the Citizens Climate Lobby. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Jay, let's start with you. Climate change lawsuits. It's about to become a thing, isn't it?
It's tried to be a thing for a while, and it's actually been going on two separate tracks, and I think you mentioned both of them in your intro. One has been attempts to try to sue polluters directly to hold them accountable and make them pay for climate damages, and that's been going on for a while without a great degree of success so far. But the second trend, which actually is rooted in the Pacific Northwest, where I am, Portland, Oregon, is so-called public trust litigation, which is an attempt to use state law and common law to get state governments and possibly even the federal government responsible for taking more action than they currently are to regulate and limit emissions.
Mehmet, has that been a more successful sort of avenue for some of these suits?
Well, it depends on what part of the country that we're talking about. A suit along those lines was brought in Minnesota and didn't really make it terribly far. But I think Jay's right that it has a little bit more traction in the Pacific Northwest.
And what are the top sort of climate lawsuits that you've been watching in the past few months? Jay, let's go back to you quickly. What do you see coming down the pipeline here?
Well, of the active suits, this public trust idea is something that's got real history out here in the West. It's the same common law or state constitutional doctrine that we use to protect our beaches, the idea that mm-hmm. the beaches are a common property owned by all the citizens of the state, and so the state has an obligation to grant access to them, keep them clean, prevent pollution, and generally manage them on behalf of all the citizens in the state. And there's a lot of scholarship to expand that idea to the atmosphere, saying air, too, is a common resource. We breathe it. Our kids breathe it. And it equally might fall under this public trust obligation, and the state should have to do something. So there's an ongoing case here in Oregon. It's currently up in the Court of Appeals where the plaintiff you mentioned, Kelsey Giuliana, who's based in Eugene, Oregon, is suing the state for further action, more regulation from our Department of Environmental Quality. And there's a parallel case very similar in Washington State, which has actually gotten further and resulted in a judge's order asking the Washington Department of Ecology, actually requiring them to issue climate rules before the end of this year. And in fact, just last week, Washington Department of Ecology issued their rule, which plaintiffs are already analyzing and saying is probably too weak to fully meet this obligation to protect the atmosphere. So there'll probably be more litigation there as well.
Mehmet, Jay mentioned that some suing like big oil and some people has been not a very fruitful path. As we move forward, you know, what do you see? Who's likely to sue? Do you think big oil will eventually be liable or others that are carbon contributors? And you know, who's going to be on the receiving end of this?
You know, it's interesting because it really depends on when we talk about suing big oil and other contributors of carbon. What are we suing them for? Is it me suing ExxonMobil because I'm concerned that they're contributing to climate change? I think those kinds of lawsuits probably don't get terribly far for a number of reasons, not least of which are questions of causation and trying to connect their activities directly to some kind of injury I personally have suffered. But there are other kinds of claims out there. So, for example, in the state of New York and now in several other states, state's attorneys general have been investigating statements that ExxonMobil has made about climate change and whether that kind of whether the statements that they've made have in some ways misled investors and so on and so forth and led to claims that that might be actionable by the attorney general.
Are you you're talking about some of the research that has come to light that they may have known that producing this kind of product and burning it would cause climate change back in the 1970s, right? Early as the 1970s.
That's right. It appears that there is research that these folks have conducted that suggests that there is a problem. And at the same time, it appears that ExxonMobil has made statements downplaying those dangers. And so the action that's being pursued in New York asks whether ExxonMobil knowingly misled investors.
We're talking about climate change and what are the costs of climate change and who's legally liable. We've got some experts in-house today. Call us if you have a question or comment, 651-227-6000, or jump in toll-free at 800-242-2828. Joe, I came across this in prep today for the show, a New York Times story about an EPA report that says by the end of the century, the United States may face up to $180 billion in economic losses because of drought and water shortages. Obviously, assessing climate change damage costs eventually could be part of this process. But when we think about cost of climate change, big picture first, and then we'll talk about individuals. But what's the big picture costs of climate change?
Well, I think I would bring back that word from the last segment, nonlinear. This is something that will certainly cost a lot more than $180 billion over the next century for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. If you just look at what the Pentagon has spent on two major wars in the first 15 years of this century, it's in the trillions. So this is a major global security threat that we're talking about. And in terms of what it will cost the United States, we're not just talking about flooding. We're not just talking about homeowners insurance and what it costs in terms of shifts in the real estate market or in different local commodities and agricultural products. We're talking about global peace and security issues, the stability of the global financial system. One example of how severe that risk is and how nonlinear it can be mm-hmm. is in 2013 on Christmas Eve, so much rain fell on the island of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, or in that small island country, that in 3 hours, 15% of its gross national product for 1 year was wiped out. And when you speak to an executive director of the IMF who has oversight over that region, his way of phrasing it was, you no longer know what the value of a dollar is. In that environment, it's very difficult to say that the risk in terms of specific dollar value is X amount. What you know is that every single thing you try to do is going to cost more.
And what about individuals? Is there any way to, you know, what are the main components that we're looking at as how does climate change cost us, you know, insurance rates? What are some of the factors that are coming to light here?
Sure. Well, if you have an insurance company that's trying to figure out what is the risk that some sort of disaster is going to befall a particular region, state, or village, they need to look at the historical record. They need to be able to quantify how much probability is there that something that happened before will happen again based on patterns. And so climate change is now taking us outside of those patterns. They're no longer easily readable as future probability. So that means they need to add cost to those policies because they need to protect themselves against the possibility that everything they have in store will end up flowing out to their clients suddenly when there's a major event. The other thing that I think is really important to think about is when you have an economy like ours that's consumption driven, some people believe that investment patterns can keep things moving and always put money into new areas. But there are staples. We need food. We need dairy products. We have a huge agricultural industry in this country. And when the agricultural industry is under pressure of a kind where from year to year, it's very difficult to know if the same crop will grow in the same place as it had before. You now have a situation where the commodities markets that deal with those food products have to deal differently, and they do something similar. They try to make sure they have a cushion. the price of doing business in that market goes up, so small players have a huge disadvantage. And we start losing competitors. And when you start losing competitors, and when there are far fewer small producers, you end up with a situation where prices start to concentrate in certain kind of mega conglomerates,
sure,
and
yeah,
prices will start to go up for everybody.
Well, and we, you know, California is 25% of the U.S. ag economy, if I'm right. So when we start to get multi-year droughts, we're in the fifth year of drought there, as these precipitation patterns change, that can happen. Mehmet, do you have any perspective here?
You know, it's a difficult question for a number of reasons. You know, in the United States, our legal traditions are really good at attaching liability when we can say this person caused me this discrete harm. But as soon as we start to move to situations where we have multiple people who may have contributed to a harm, or harms that are slow to accumulate, not mm-hmm. to say not real, but
sure,
slow to accumulate, and when do we reach a threshold that the judicial system wants to approach them, then our system isn't as skilled at dealing with those kinds of harms.
You know, Jay, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are as you're sitting here listening to this out on the left coast, so to speak, in Portland.
Well, I agree with Mehmet. I really think that has been the answer from courts to date, that our system, particularly our common law judicial system, basically has trouble wrapping its head around something like climate change.
Mm-hmm.
This has been nuisance law. If I'm a polluter and I have a factory with a smokestack and it belches soot in your yard next door and on your laundry and on your pets, the courts can handle that. I could even do it at a large scale, tens of thousands of people, and there are ways that our system can adjudicate that, class actions and other things, and make me pay. But if I'm emitting greenhouse gases that go up to the stratosphere, mingle with all the other greenhouse gas molecules, identical molecules, there's a cumulative effect that causes global warming, and then through a complex chain of causation that you probably know more about than I would as a lawyer, it changes climate, it changes our weather patterns, it enhances storm events and causes damage. It's very difficult for courts to then have a plaintiff in front of them and a defendant in front of them and say, as a result of all that, this defendant owes this plaintiff X.
Right.
That said, I do think a door is opening. I agree with Mehmet that the journalism, the investigations into the oil corporations and what they might have known much earlier than people thought about CO2 and the effects of their products' emissions as early as the 60s, that's a revelation, that there may be some divergence between what they knew internally from objective science and what they said publicly. And courts are better at weighing documents and statements and comparing them, and that gets you away from the nuisance law theory and into possible theories, and I stress possible, like fraud, which is currently the subject of some state AG investigations. Did you know something and then say something else in public?
Mm-hmm.
Product liability theory, which, you know, were you pushing a dangerous product out into the marketplace, in which case it starts to look less like a classic pollution case and more like the tobacco litigation, or even securities litigation, where the question becomes, did you fail to disclose to your investors and shareholders that you knew that you had this potential liability on your books, but you didn't say anything to the financial markets? So all those doors are opening.
All right, let's go to the phones. Matt is with us from Matamidi. Good morning, Matt. What's your question?
Well, I appreciate taking my call. So you're talking about projections for billions of dollars that could affect our economy or world economy. And what I'm wondering is adaptation. Is climate adaptation being factored into those estimations? And then also, what about the cost as far as research for climate adaptation? Because I know in other parts of the world, in Europe in particular, they're looking at what's going to happen a couple hundred years from now and trying to figure out how we're going to adapt to those conditions versus maybe here in the United States. I think we're behind in our research universities looking only decades ahead. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's being done to factor in the money that's going to take for the research for the adaptation, because people politically and socially maybe haven't accepted climate change, but scientifically it's been accepted.
Yeah, good question, Matt. Thank you. Joe, you know, this kind of goes back to the piece I mentioned that I saw Thomson Reuters, their sustainability magazine about Miami-Dade County spending $13 billion on raising their sewer and water systems higher to stay ahead of sea level rise. Adaptation, how does it factor into the costs and eventually the legality going forward?
Well, you know, there's the constant problem of whether we're able to deal efficiently with the difficulties that we face. Right now, we already have a kind of backlog in necessary work on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with that already.
Right.
Now we need to figure out how to make all that infrastructure climate resilient. That may not cost more than the backlog. The backlog kind of gives us a little leeway there. But
sure.
Over time, if we don't start fixing these things, if we don't start mitigating the problem, the cost of adaptation and resilience is going to be far, far higher than we can really reasonably handle.
Let's go to the phones again. Catherine in Minneapolis, good morning to you. What's your question or comment?
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention, because I'm a shareholder and I followed the recent annual meeting in May, Berkshire Hathaway, which is a major insurance company among other businesses they do, has had a shareholder resolution this past May. Unfortunately, it failed, but it was offered by the Nebraska Peace Foundation. And it was regarding factoring climate change and doing research and a report on including specific initiatives and goals relating to each risk issued identified and on responses to the risks of their insurance posed by climate change. And the reason this was significant is because Berkshire Hathaway is a major reinsurer. They do the Supercat insurance. And the significance is that this is the second shareholder proposal in two or three years. The first one was on a dam in the Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest, but we've seen two proposals come now on climate change or environmental issues. So, you know, I'm thinking that there's also grassroots activism going on with the insurance companies. And, yes, I personally, as a shareholder, am very concerned about the potential lawsuits that could go against this company. So if there's more information people want, they can go to the website, berkshirehathaway.com, and
okay.
check it out. So
thank
I just thought I'd mention it. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Catherine. You know, this is interesting from a number of angles. I mean, there's the liability, the legal liability. There's insurance costs. You know, how does this, Mehmet, how does this process kind of play out as we go forward with the intersection of all these things? Is it case by case in the legal system? Is that kind of how this plays out in the legal sense?
Well, one way it could play out is through federal legislation, but I think we all know that the political realities there probably foreclose that particular avenue. So I think the answer is yes to all of the above. I think that, you know, some of the different kinds of sort of novel litigation approaches, the atmospheric trust litigation stuff that that Jay's been talking about. I think we see where that goes. I think insurance companies continue to get more and more concerned about this and mm-hmm. the pressure they start to put on their clients. And also, you know, in connection with what the previous caller said, I mean, you know, activism takes all kinds of forms. And shareholders might start to get a little bit agitated about this as well.
Jay, climate change, extreme weather, you know, we like to say sea level rise. They really don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, and the legal system doesn't care either, right, as these things go forward?
I think that's definitely true. I think that message may have yet to sink in politically.
Mm-hmm.
As a legal matter, I think there will, going forward, be much less problem demonstrating the issue and the facts, that there really is a problem. I don't think you'll get that kind of skepticism out of the judiciary that you might see in political action. So then it becomes, you know, what happens next? If we agree this is happening, that it's dire, that it's costly, as we've discussed, and you want to find someone to hold responsible or find at least another pool of resources to at least try to address the problem, how can the legal system help with that? And that, as we've been saying, is so far where the system has bogged down. But I do think there are a couple more things on the horizon that will, again, sharpen the issues in a way that make the legal system amenable to resolving them. You know, one, which I'm sure you've been talking about with your listeners, is climate attribution science, the
mm-hmm.
Improvement of climate science to the point where it can say with increasing scientific certainty that specific events were caused by climate change or enhanced by climate
change.
Correct,
yeah, especially enhanced, yes, right.
The other piece, which is really useful for the legal system, and it's less science and more detective work, is something called the Carbon Majors Study. If you just Google Carbon Majors, you'd get a raft of information on that. But this is really sort of forensic work based on the idea that the entire 200-year history we've been using fossil fuels, there's a finite number of companies that have produced them ever since we started digging coal from the ground or oil. And you can trace those, and it's manageable. A lot of them are large state companies in Russia or Brazil or elsewhere. A lot of them are large corporations that have merged and become even larger corporations. And you can go through history and look at their shareholder reports and see what they produced. And that at least gives you some idea of the extent to which that particular industry may have contributed to the problem. And again, that sort of market share approach is something that courts are able to wrestle with when it comes to thinking about how you might start to apportion liability.
Joe, you and I were on a panel for the Nobel Peace Prize Forum here earlier this week in the Twin Cities, and we focused a little bit on civics and climate change and some of those areas. I just wanted to note this, that South Florida is kind of an interesting example. They have sort of a climate change cooperative, Palm Beach, Broward, Monroe, Dade counties working together. Folks there are saying it's fairly unusual that this happens, is brought by climate change and sea level rise. Get this, the council is 13 commissioners, 6 Democrats, 6 Republicans, and 1 independent, and they're all united on the issue. This, again, is a quote from the Thomson Reuters sustainability piece. It makes strange bedfellows, doesn't it? I mean, as the effects begin to manifest.
Well, I think you mentioned the Nobel Peace Prize Forum, and one of the things I took away from those wonderful days was that interpersonal responsibility is not a burden. Actually, it's a joy. We're better off when we collaborate. We can do more. We can be more creative. We can respond more effectively to crisis, and I think that's what is happening in South Florida. You also have Congressman Carlos Corbello, a Republican, and Congressman Ted Deutch, a Democrat, who came together to form the Climate Solutions Caucus. It's a bipartisan caucus in the House of Representatives. It is the first ever bipartisan climate caucus in the House of Representatives. And you cannot join this caucus unless you bring a member of the other party with you. Mm-hmm. So there's been real movement there. And I just want to say that, you know, we've been talking about liability and who's liable for what.
Right.
There's an integrity issue. On the other side of fraud is integrity. So some of the companies that are being examined, they have not only been aware of climate change, they've studied the fact that it exists. They know how it's happening. They know that it causes sea levels to rise. They have monitored that because they have to plan around the rising sea levels. They have to evaluate what is it going to cost if we have to bring our materials into port at this height versus this height over decades. And so they have actively planned to profit knowing that this is happening and adjusting so that they get a better deal. At the same time, telling others it's not happening. They know that that rising sea level causes risk to their bottom line. They also know it causes risk to inhabited areas. And so that's a clear case where the integrity problem is very real. And if you look at some of the lawsuits that are out there, one of the anchors in law is actually the United States Constitution itself, which is presented in order to secure to ourselves and our posterity the blessings of liberty. And I believe there's one federal court where that claim has been upheld so the case can move forward. That says that the logic of intergenerational responsibility is already deeply embedded in our legal system. And I think that now creates the situation where companies increasingly have to look at how do we transition to a business model where we can have integrity and where we can sell something that is real and viable to investors. And you see in the oil sector, major global corporations that are actually now actively examining how do we transition from where we are, go through a policy change that puts a price on carbon emissions that's high enough to push investment out of combustible fuels altogether so that our business model can be something that is cost effective for us, profitable, good for the world, and where we take those same hydrocarbon molecules that we're good at getting at and we turn them into advanced materials. We turn them into things that can be environmentally friendly, that can help actually contain emissions and prevent climate change.
We got only about a minute left, guys. This is a great discussion, but we touched on this, and Mehmet, I want you to comment on this quickly, if you could. Morally and legally, we all use carbon, right? We're all responsible at some level. What are your thoughts on that, given your legal experience?
Well, I mean, it's a classic problem. How much of this, how much do individuals own in this situation? That said, you know, some folks are making more money off of this than others, and so to the extent we characterize it as a moral issue, I have to agree with Joe that there is some question of integrity there. Also, just very briefly, you know, we've been focusing on the United States legal system. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that there's a European Union. There are many other legal systems where the kinds of barriers we've been talking about may not pose the same kinds of issues.
Jay Austin, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess I would just say in the same way as with the tobacco litigation, eventually the blame was shifted from individual smokers to the companies and their marketing practices and what they did and didn't know and when they didn't know it. I think you're going to see some of that same kind of shift here with carbon consumption.
You know, you guys, every week I do this show, I'm increasingly trying to keep a clear sort of unemotional head about the incredibly complicated realities here. Every week I'm learning that the science, practical and now legal changes ahead are seeming even more dramatic than I thought they ever could be. I want to thank you guys for a great discussion today. Jay Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Paul.
Professor Mehmet Konar-Steinberg from Mitchell-Hamlin Law School in St. Paul, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
And Joseph Robertson, Citizens Climate Lobby, thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
That's it for ClimateCast this week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can't see the whole world's weather out your front window, but you can hear about it here.